Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello. And this week we are rating Damien Chazelle's Bacchanalian Babylon, Iranian serial killer thriller Holy Spider, and Anna Kendrick's look at coercive relationships, Alice Darling. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, Jordan?
Like much of the planet, I've been watching The Last of Us, the new HBO post-apocalyptic video game adaptation, which I am very much enjoying. I'm actually lucky enough to have seen all 9 episodes because I'm a very privileged journo. So I'm sort of ahead of the curve on this one a little bit. And I was a huge fan of the game when it came out in 2013 as well. So I'm well aware what this is. But I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was excellent. It stars Pedro Pascal as Joel Miller. It sort of opens in 2003 and we very quickly see the kind of fall of civilization due to this thing called the cordyceps fungal infection. It kind of turns people into these crazy zombie types. And then the show cuts to 20 years later. The whole world has collapsed, but pockets of humanity have sort of survived. Joel is living in a kind of quarantine zone in Boston. And it's there that he takes this job escorting a young woman called Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, who you may recognize from Game of Thrones. She played Lyanna Mormont. It's his job to kind of escort her outside the quarantine zone and deliver her to this group of freedom fighters. So in short, the show is sort of about their journey cross country while avoiding zombies and terrible people as this sort of surrogate father-daughter relationship sort of develops and horrible, terrible things happen to everyone that they encounter, basically. But I thought it was just excellent. The game is generally held up as probably one of the best written, best acted, most cinematic games ever made. And this is a very sort of faithful adaptation of that story. Obviously, video games are notorious for the sense that all the adaptations are terrible for the most part. But this one is being held up as one of the best because A, it's very faithful to very good source material. And B, what it does do differently is it just sort of expands on what you get in the game. So you just get the game plus a bit more. There's one just truly exceptional episode near the start of the season, which I'm obviously not going to spoil for people.
Is this episode 3?
It's episode 3, episode 3. Everyone knows, but that is just a complete deviation from the game. Like, you don't see any of that in the game, basically. And it's a really, really special hour of TV. I thought it was really beautiful. So even if you know the game, you're still getting something more. You're still getting something more really, really good. So I really, really like this. I would highly recommend that you watch it.
Everyone I know is watching this. I haven't got round to it yet, but I do know that I need a box of tissues for episode 3.
And episode 1, it starts hard. It has like the up quality where you're just like crying within in this case, the first episode of the TV show. Yeah, so it's a really, really good show.
Cool. I went on a plane to LA last week. So I had 11 hours in the sky, which, as you know, I refer to as a spa in the sky because it's nice. You can't get emails. You've got like a whole load of films to watch. People bring you food. What's not to like? And I watched a documentary that I'd missed when it came out, Val, about Val Kilmer. Did you see this one?
I didn't, really want to.
It's really interesting. What a really interesting guy he is. And he has been documenting his life with video, home video, all of his life. He's a bit of a sort of fableman in as much as he was one of the kids that got a home video and has always made little films and has always documented his life. So he has this rich archive of, him messing around behind the scenes on Top Gun and everything, and Willow and all of these things. And so he's put together this sort of, it's not a documentary really necessarily about him, it's about art as well as him and being an actor. And it really delves into the sort of process of acting, which I found fascinating. And, going to drama school and with, all of these amazing other actors that came out of there and then doing a Broadway show with like this very young Sean Penn and Kevin Bacon, who are just mooning for the camera. It actually was really fascinating. And he came out of it quite enigmatically, I must say. And it really changed my mind about Val Kilmer because I've obviously heard the stories, I'm sure you have, that he's difficult to work with, blah, blah, blah. And then when you sort of, obviously this is only his point of view, but when you peel back what he says that process is and why he's difficult, it's because he's asking questions, and maybe he's asking questions of creatives that they don't have answers to or that are showing them up in some cases. I mean, certainly on the island of Dr. Moreau, the footage from that is quite incredible. Marlon Brando just properly cursing it in the corner. Him and his cast members, you know, just despairing with this appalling shoot that's going to absolute hell. So, yeah, it was a fascinating documentary. And, you know, the other thing I was looking at, you know, I have to say, was Elvis's artifacts. I went to this amazing party that was a celebration of the Elvis film, which I kind of like. Don't know if I've mentioned. And yeah, and I went to a party with Baz Luhrmann and Austin Butler, but also at this party was Lisa Marie Presley and her daughter Riley, all manner of Hollywood glitterati, but also the archivist at Graceland had flown in on a private jet with some of the King's artifacts. And
wow,
with white gloves, I got to touch his cape from Aloha from Hawaii, look at his TCB ring, pick up the keys from Graceland, look at his gold glasses, his famous gold glasses. They, what else? They had his belt from the International Hotel that he wore at the press conference. My mind was blown. And then a cake came in that Baz had created. You know, we all sang Can't Help Falling in Love for Elvis on his 88th birthday with Lisa Marie. It was crazy. Having a little disco dance night with Baz Luhrmann, hell of a night. It was like a cheese dream, Jordan. So watching that go on was incredible. So yeah, and then I attended the Golden Globes. So that was also, you know, Jurassic Park with the fences down. What's going on? Hung out with Lisa Marie Presley at the Golden Globes. Crazy, yeah. Crazy.
Really sad.
Very, very sad, obviously, what has happened since. I can't really believe it, but very, very grateful that I got to meet her. Because she was very sort of snarky, funny, and sweet. And I thought she was a great personality, what little I saw of her. So it's so sad that she's gone.
Yeah, really sad. Yeah. This is a bit of a hard left turn after that. But who was the most drunk person you saw at the Golden Globes?
Nobody. God knows. They
were nobody was drunk.
Nobody was. No, I saw Miles Teller at the bar ordering a martini. You know, I saw various other people walking around with their Moet champagne glasses. But on the whole, you know, these Hollywood people drink their bottled water and go home and have a good early night because they need to, don't they, for their skin. No debauchery.
It's disappointing. I thought the whole point of the Globes was that everyone could get drunk while they were there. It's like the unhinged Oscars, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's magnums of champagne on the table for you to just guzzle. And you get dinner. Obviously, none of the celebrities eat their dinner. They literally sit down and ask for the plate to be cleared. But obviously, people like us who enjoy a free meal, I was stuck into the three courses.
Hoovered it down.
But then what they do is they have this little sidebar. So in between, in the commercial breaks, you can just go and off screen, be in a sidebar where you can have a drink, and they have platters of food, and all of them are just eating all the meats because they're just on, you know, the proteins. So, you know, just having some sliced meats and a glass of champagne in the corner and then back to the seat. So that's how it works. But it was fascinating to have a look behind the scenes. I went as a guest of a producer. So it was really interesting to see how it all worked from what you're watching on TV to what actually happens in the room. Yeah, really good. And it was great, you know, to see the Elvis team win with Austin Butler, and off he went and did that speech, which has been subject to much discussion as well. It felt very emotional when in the room.
Does seem that he's basically turned into Elvis now. Like,
no.
Him and Elvis are indistinguishable.
So I think
one and the same.
So I chatted to him before that, and he doesn't sound like Elvis. And I think what happens is when he is trying to get his nerves together, that slips in because that's what he's channeled to be a persona on stage. And this is my personal theory. Austin, you can correct me if this is not the thing, but I think when he gets on stage, some weird like muscle memory switch happens and he talks a little bit more Elvis. When you talk to him normally, he doesn't sound Elvis.
Right, okay. As Elvis, yeah.
There is a southern inflection, definitely, that hasn't gone away, but he doesn't sound like Elvis.
A lot of people on the internet would disagree with you.
Yeah. Oh, bless him. I thought it was a very sweet speech. And, you know, it was really nice that, you know, people were in the room to hear him say it. So
He's got to have a good chance at the Oscar now, right? Like, it seems to be between him and Brendan Fraser.
Well, yeah, you say that. But then Critics' Choice, it was Brendan won that. Colin mm-hmm. and he both won one at the Golden Globe. So I still think it's a three-horse mm. race, don't you?
I'm terrible at predicting these things, so who really knows? But yeah, for me, it's between those two. Fraser and Butler, those are the best performances I saw last year. Definitely.
Colin Farrell and his eyebrows.
I love Colin Farrell. Lovely. I watched Banshees of Inisherin again last week.
Just to enjoy Jenny.
Film. Yeah, well, that was the hardest bit, Jenny. Just so bittersweet, the whole film, once you know where it's going. But yeah, he's great in it. He's really good. But I thought Austin Butler and Brendan Fraser just went a little bit further with it, you know?
The thing that Brendan Fraser doesn't like.
Mm. Oh, am I? What doesn't he like?
Because he's not Brendan Fraser. He's Brendan Fraser.
Oh, Brendan Fraser. Okay. I didn't realize this was a sticking
point. For years, he says, people have been saying his name wrong. He's not Fraser. Oh. He's Fraser.
Well, I'm deeply sorry, Brendan. I didn't know.
Next time you see him. Yeah, get it right. Cool. Right. We digress. The other thing we should talk about is what we've got coming up this week, because today is the start of Sundance and we are attending, not physically, sadly, much as we do enjoy trudging through the snow. We are doing it remotely. Have you had a little look at what's coming up? Is there anything that's floating your boat and tickling your fancy?
Yeah, it looks like a really good lineup this year. A couple that stood out to me, Cat Person, which is an adaptation of that New Yorker article. Obviously, as previously discussed on the podcast, you and me, Jane, are big fans of kind of con people articles.
This is so our film, isn't it?
It's totally our jam. This stars Emilia Jones from Coda, of course, and Nicholas Braun from Succession. It's a kind of millennial love story and about just uncomfortable modern romance, essentially. If you read the article, you'll probably know what to expect. But if not, I'm sure that will be very, very good. And I'm also excited about Eileen, which is William Oldroyd's new film, director of Lady Macbeth, which, of course, gave Florence Pugh her big break a few years ago. That's based on a best-selling novel, stars Anne Hathaway and Thomasin McKenzie. Actually, I haven't read the novel, so I don't know a ton about that one. But yeah, I'm glad to see William Oldroyd back on the scene. It's been too long.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested in the Michael J. Fox documentary that's going to be there. Actually, mm-hmm. there's a lot of documentaries that fascinate me. But the Michael J. Fox one, which I think will be a really good insight into his life and his, you know, diagnosis and how that's affected him. There's also a Little Richard documentary and his impact as a queer artist, which I think will be really interesting. And of course, Judy Blume Forever, which is about Judy Blume, which, if you're my generation, she's actually, you know, a goddess in books for when I was growing up. So those are things that I'm interested in. And also I'm kind of interested in, you know, Jonathan Majors is really just on an absolute run right now. And he's got this magazine Dreams, which is a bodybuilding film. Presumably he got in shape for that and Creed 3. But yeah, I'm interested to see that. There's a lot of intriguing stuff there this year. I can't wait. We will be, of course, doing a roundup in Mag and online of the best of the fest. So do watch out for that. Should we look at what we can see, though, in the cinemas this week? So it's time to party then with this.
I think what we have here in Hollywood is high art. It's
if you could go anywhere in the whole world, where would you go?
I always wanted to be part of something bigger.
Yes.
Let's go! Something that lasts, that means something.
You know, when I first moved to LA,
I got your face touching it, Linda.
You know what the signs on all the doors read? No actors or dogs allowed.
So this is Damien Chazelle's Babylon. It's been in the awards conversation, hasn't so far really won anything. Jordan, what's it about?
Yeah, so this is set in the golden age of Hollywood, specifically during the transition from the heyday of silent movies to the talkies, which was, you know, essentially like learning a whole new craft for some filmmakers. The film itself, it's 3 hours, 9 minutes long. It's a drug-fueled odyssey, which tracks sort of four central characters. First, there's Manny, played by Diego Calva. He's a Mexican immigrant working as a kind of runner for a film executive, doing things like pushing elephants up the side of a very steep hill for a wild party that opens this film, a sequence which has an outrageously scatological conclusion, yes. I'll say.
There's a lot of bodily fluids in this film.
just tons, like so much, like Mr. Creosote levels of bodily fluids at multiple points during this film. So be prepared for that. The second character is Margot Robbie's Nellie LeRoy. She's this wild child wannabe movie star who gets her big break after this, after kind of Spirited Dancing at this party, which opens the film, gets her noticed. Then you have Brad Pitt, who plays Jack Conrad. He's an established silent movie matinee idol. He's at the top of the world. His career is at its absolute peak, but has his legs effectively sort of cut out from underneath him, because when people actually hear him talk on screen, they realize he's a bit of a laughing stock. And finally, there's Sidney Palmer, played by Giovanna Depo. He's a black trumpet player, musician, and obviously his skill set becomes highly valued in the transition to talkies and the advent of sound in movies. And he essentially becomes the sort of star of movies as well, even though his story is, I would say, probably significantly less developed than the rest. So it feels like more of a three-hander with a little bit extra with this other character. So yeah, I mean, a lot of the stories in this film, they're drawn from real life, real people. And some of the parallels are very thinly veiled, I would say. Nellie LeRoy is, you know, very clearly supposed to be kind of a Clara Bow type character, you know, a star who burned twice as bright but half as long, like that type of figure. Pitt is very clearly John Gilbert. There are sort of too many nods for it to be anyone else, really. Sidney is sort of Duke Ellington. So you have all these things going on where he's sort of drawing from history. But then you also do have real people in it as well, who go by their real names. So there's a bit of fiction, a bit of fact mixed in into this melting pot of ideas. Mm. But it's one of those films where it's very clearly a filmmaker who sort of cashed in all their goodwill, essentially, that they've built over their last few films to create just a true kind of passion project kind of thing that they could just never get made at any other point in their career. And for that, I just hugely respect it, because it's just this sort of crazed, hedonistic tapestry of a time in Hollywood which we'll surely never see the likes of again. I mean, it opens with this sort of bravura 45 plus minute party sequence, which is among the most sort of audacious things I saw on screen last year. I saw this film late last year, even though it's coming out here imminently. It's essentially like what Chazelle does at the end of Whiplash, that sort of intense music driven set piece, but stretched sort of five times as long. But after that, there's almost like a sketch-like quality to the film, because instead of sort of scenes jumping back and forth, you just get, in a sort of traditional sense, you just get these 20 to 30 minute almost sequences all focused on one sort of situation. So you can almost kind of point to certain things and go, that was great, I didn't like that as much. It almost feels very sketchy in that way. Like there's the sequence which follows this party. It's a series of films being made. It's two or three films being made at the same time on this single location in the middle of Hollywood somewhere. And it's just so wild and insane. There's this war movie that's going on that's being directed by this Eric von Stroheim stand-in, played amazingly by Spike Jonze, complete with a cartoonish German accent.
Yeah.
That's a film that Brad Pitt character is shooting. Then you also have Nelly shooting a completely different film. It's her first film.
A saloon bar kind of thing.
Exactly, like a Western type of thing. So she's sort of proving that she has her chops as a silent movie star. And all this is going on at the same time. And it's all cutting and crossing together. And it's all just builds and builds and builds. And it has such a great payoff. And I just loved all that stuff. But then it is a 3-hour and 9-minute film. So it inevitably is going to drag at points. And it just can't sustain that momentum for the whole thing. So I really, really love this in sort of fits and starts. There's another great scene with Robbie's character, Nellie LeRoy, where she's filming her first talkie. And you just see everyone really struggling to get it, because they have to perfectly sync the sound. They have to make sure that the mic's picking everything up. Everyone on set has to be completely silent so that the mics don't pick up any other noise other than what Nellie is saying in character. And the way this just builds and builds, and everyone gets more incensed and incensed. And I just absolutely loved that sequence. I was so entertained by it. But yeah, there are like bits that really drag here. And it is a shame that it was so sort of, I don't want to say indulgent, but just so wild and so like untamed. Like it just felt like if someone went in and with a little bit of a scalpel, it could have been a little bit more complete as a film. But here as it is, it's just so sprawling and wild. I feel like inevitably you're going to have some issues with it.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is indulgent. It's a film of like three bits for me. And that the first 40 minutes that you're talking about, the first hour, is intoxicating for me. Absolutely. I was just like, that party, you know, there's naked women, there's an elephant, there's somebody on a pogo stick that's like a dick, there's mountains of cocaine, there's party streamers, there's a jazz band, there's dancing, there's this soundtrack that's insistent, like a heartbeat. It's a trip, an absolute trip. And then all of these different people walking in and out of this scene, and their different lives that are happening. And then there's, you know, sort of orgies happening. There's somebody, you know, doing some wet play in another room. I mean, it's crazy. And that idea of 20s Hollywood being so wild is really realized. And I loved the whole Brad Pitt in the middle of this as this, you know, this star that is fading, has been a huge, huge star, but is fading on the cusp of this new technology and struggling to find his feet within it. But he does this huge speech about art that, you know, he could do right now in any room and would still be valid. And I loved that, as you say, all that bit with where we're looking at different films being made and the absolute chaos of it and people just running riot and it just being like herding cats. Loved it. And then it falls off a cliff for me. And then it's like he was allowed to run wild, as you say, and then tried to corral it back into a final section to make sense of that. And the making sense of that actually makes none of it make sense. And the sort of the fact that it so closely cleaves to Singing in the Rain, I didn't understand why he would do that, because Singing in the Rain is already an absolutely awesome film about the arrival of talkies and the disaster that has on people's careers. And it's perfect. It can't be improved upon. So why are you trying to do that again? And then there's this sort of Kubrickian end piece that's all kind of like, come on now. Yeah, it absolutely exasperated me and I fell out with it completely by the end. But I think it's totally worth watching to see a filmmaker that's like, he's literally has just said, sod it. Let's throw everything at this. I mean, literally the kitchen sink is in this film, including Tobey Maguire in a very bizarre, I mean, this whole section, no spoilers, but there's a whole section about sort of the underbelly of Hollywood, which is very weird as well.
It's a real sort of descent into hell, isn't it? Yeah. It almost turns into a sort of horror movie at one point.
And then, you know, all the time you're like, oh, this is Day of the Locusts. You know, this is The Last Tycoon. This is, you know, like there's so much sort of that era art that you are referencing. And I think that's detrimental, because then I'm just thinking The Day of the Locusts is already a fantastic, you know, book and film. I don't need another version of it. So I agree with you. I think it would have been good had he had somebody to say, love what you're doing, Damien, but I think this could be reined in. I mean, there's a scene, you didn't mention it, but there's a scene with like vomiting that is, it reminded me of The Farce Show, which is not something that I want to be linking Chazelle to. It felt really tonally weird in the middle of this. Yeah, it's just, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's wild. I had no idea that Chazelle had this in him, to be honest. I was so surprised just how extreme it went at points. You had a few issues with the ending, as mentioned. We're not going to go into details, obviously, but I sort of loved it. I loved just how sincere it was, just how huge a sort of swing it was. Without spoiling anything, it's meant to be taken as a sort of celebration of movies generally, and B, a sort of lament for what cinema is now, what it's become, what we've let happen to it, essentially. Like, look at what we're losing if we don't kind of start going to the cinema again and start watching films again. Like he's saying, you know, don't let cinemas die, essentially, which I really loved. I loved just how sincere a statement that was at the end of all this, even though you've seen something like, I don't think that we should return to this era. Like, I don't think, you know, people should be sniffing mountains of coke at parties with elephants in Hollywood. Like, that's not good. But I do think that movie making as an art form, it's absolutely vital. And it's a real sort of tragedy, the position that cinemas and movies in general have found themselves in at the moment. They're a real sort of breaking point, it almost feels like. And yeah, it's just interesting that he's commenting on that fact like so sincerely, especially in contrast to a film like La La Land, which is so like, it's so like celebratory of Hollywood. Like, it's so like upbeat, even though it has a bit of a bittersweet ending. You're meant to come out of that go, aren't movies great? Whereas this, I came out of it went, oh no, have we ruined movies? Are we never going to have movies like this again? Like, it almost feels like, I don't know, the last movie in a way. Like, if this was the last movie ever made, like, I would sort of understand it as a cap on all movies. But it's very hard to talk about without going into details.
Yes. Yeah. I get what you're saying. And I do think this is a film that should be seen and should be seen on a big screen with that sound mm-hmm. system. So you can hear that those trumpets blaring throughout. It does feel like it asks audiences to question what they want from their art and whether they're happy with safe bets, franchises, mm-hmm. IP, known IP, movies that have been made by committee and pushed through the lens of a, you know, screenings. And do we get the art that we deserve? And as audiences, maybe we need to ask for more, I guess, is what he's saying, which I'm totally on board with. But having said that, I think you need somebody to edit your stuff, Damien.
Yeah, I think putting it at the end of a 3-hour and 9-minute film is a big ask of anyone. I mean, the box office figures in America have shown that people haven't really turned out to this in droves. They don't seem to be particularly interested, which is a little bit of a surprise when you have people like, you know, Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt headlining it from an Oscar-winning filmmaker. You know, maybe there just isn't the audience for this type of thing. Maybe people were put off by that runtime. Maybe people just wanted to go see Avatar: The Way of Water for the 4th or 5th time. Like,
oh my God, I mean, I totally, if I have to watch another 3-hour film, it's this rather than Avatar. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? There's these two big films and one is sort of saying, is Avatar what you really want? And, you know, Avatar is saying, this is what you really want. And it's an interesting discussion. Which of those is what you want, you know?
Well, yes, it does say that, but it does endorse Avatar.
Yes, like,
quite
of course.
Directly,
absolutely.
That I won't spoil. But,
no, absolutely. It really does nod to it as a groundbreaking and changing thing and something that mm-hmm. did get bums on seats and probably inspired an entire generation, the first Avatar. What's going to be really good about this film for anyone that goes to see it is if you go see it with your mates, you are going to have plenty to talk about afterwards and argue about.
I honestly think if you go and see it, you'll have a really good time as well. There are 3 or 4 sequences in this which are absolutely mesmerizing. Like, really a filmmaker just firing on all cylinders. Like, he's so good when he's on it, and he's on it for like at least half of this film, like at least 90 minutes of this film is like about as good as filmmaking gets. It's just the rest could have used a bit of work.
Yes, indeed. And there is an amazing scene with a film journalist who tells an actor mm-hmm. exactly where they are in the food chain that I would dream of having conversations with some of the people I interview. I love that. But there we go. Anyway, so I think we're saying Babylon is definitely worth your while.
Yeah, if you've got a spare 3 hours and 9 minutes, definitely do go check it out.
Yeah, and don't go on a full stomach, because if you feel a bit queasy about...
Feeling a bit nauseous.
Yeah, poo, wee, or sick. That's the starting point for the bodily fluids. Okay, so that is Babylon, and that is out in cinemas this Friday. All right, so let's move on to something that's a bit more sobering. It's time for some real-life chills with this.
الان نمیدونم یه قاتل انکبوتی میگن چیه اصلا به خودم فقط شنیدم
شش هفت ماه دنبالشن خب اصلا گیرش نمیارم
چطوره که شما هنوز سر نخی پیدا نکردید
یک بیک هیچ دار از بین مبروم اون از بردار نیام.
So this is Holy Spider. Based on real events, Jordan, Iranian, mm-hmm. what's going on in this?
Yeah, as you say, based on the real life case of the so-called spider killer who operated in Iran and believed he was sort of cleansing the streets of sex workers. It's heavily inspired by Seven and especially Zodiac. That's sort of the register that we're operating in here. It stars Zar Amir Ebrahimi as a journalist called Rahimi. She is investigating the murders, trying to discover the man's identity because the police seem to have a vested interest, shall we say, in not exposing this person. What makes this interesting is that we also follow the spider killer himself. He's called Saeed, as he goes about his killings, which are depicted in quite brutal, unflinching fashion. And this character's attempts to sort of conceal his extremely dark nighttime activities from his wife and children. So yeah, the sort of fascinating thing about this film is what it says about society's lack of concern about violence against women generally. because these killings in a perverse way sort of align with the patriarchal values of Iranian culture. And he's sort of seen as a hero by some, or at least someone who is targeting people that others believe shouldn't be on the streets in the first place, which is sort of obviously disgusting, but is like a reflection of the harsh reality of life. Rahimi herself, she's a character who faces sort of misogyny and unwanted advances at every turn, in part because she has this unfair reputation as a woman of, quote, loose morals, because of a sort of a previous encounter with a man who she turned down, which has spread and spread. And there are actually interesting parallels with Amir Ebrahimi's real life, because she was the victim of revenge porn in 2008, and she's lived in exile from Iran ever since then. So she suffered an even more extreme version of what her character sort of goes through on screen, and I think she is able to sort of essay that sort of lived experience here. There is some creative license. The reporter Rahimi, the real life person that this is based on, she wasn't on the street sort of investigating the spider killer. She wasn't like dressing up as a prostitute and trying to ensnare him. But she did report on his trial, and she was the person who reported his final words, which actually unlocked a lot of the narrative for Ali Abbasi, who's the writer-director here. Naturally, there's been a ton of controversy about this as well, particularly in Iran. Yeah. Where, you know, the film has been resoundingly criticized. I think immediately after Cannes, they might put out a statement, even though surely no one actually in Iran had seen it at that point, unless they were at the press screening of the film at Cannes, which, you know, I doubt it. But I thought this was excellent. Not an easy watch at all. Very upsetting at times. In fact, it opens with an absolutely brutal killing, just really, really horrible. And there's at least a couple more of those. But for me, it was sort of the best film of its ilk since Zodiac, I would say. And as a portrait of sort of modern day Iran, it really sort of pulls no punches.
I felt very conflicted about it, I have to say. Like, I liked the fact that it really was unflinching in showing violence against women. But I also really disliked that at the same time. Because, you know, these women are not afforded any kind of backstory. There's a tiny bit about who they are, but they're just literal victims. And we're concentrating on the killer rather than the women. And the murders are brutal. And the fact that these women are strangled with their headscarves seems very part of the MO of this guy who truly believes he's doing God's work. So for me, the actual investigation and the catching of him was less interesting than what happened when he actually stood up in court and explained himself, and the groundswell of support for him, the fact that his son felt conflicted about his father's actions and was sort of impressed with it, but also horrified by it, the sort of, you know, the toxic masculinity at work in society, the patriarchal aspect of it, the idea that even his wife says, you know, these women were worthless. Women who are serving men as prostitutes. So are they? Of course they're not. I found that part more interesting, I think, than the actual catching of the killer. But yeah, you know, you say Zodiac, it does share that sort of vibe. And also I felt kind of Denis Villeneuve as well. The oppressive soundtrack and the shots and the cinematography reminded me of that. So it's a very sort of elegant film in that way to watch. And I really liked the sort of aspects of the female reporter that was trying to unlock this case was experiencing exactly the same thing, as you said, on a different scale. And, you know, sexual advances, belittlement, and just everyday sexism for going about her business and doing her job and wanting to, you know, stay in a hotel room when she wasn't married, which is apparently absolutely not okay. Like, that's so disrespectful. And it's a sort of, it's an interesting little window on Iran as well. I mean, it's obviously in the news a lot at the moment. And although this is 20 years ago.
Yeah, 2000,
Yeah, so it's 20 years ago. It's not modern Iran, but it is really interesting to sort of get a sense of the country and the place. They didn't obviously film there, did they, Jordan?
No, they filmed in Jordan, funnily enough. It was meant to be Turkey, but then they sort of got kicked out of there as well. Like, everyone sort of got wind of how controversial this was going to be. And obviously they were never going to be allowed to film in Mashhad, which is in Iran, which is where it's actually set.
Yeah. And obviously that's a very interesting town as well, because it's it's a pilgrimage town. There is
a holy city,
a holy city. So this is all wrapped up in ideas about morals and immoral acts, and whether you deserve to live or die, because what does God say about this? So it's really interesting, and you can see why this is really controversial and why Iran would really be unhappy with it, and why it would be something that you can watch, and again, another film this week that you could go with your friends and have a really good chat after about various themes that it brings up.
Yeah, it's a really meaty film in that sense. There's a hell of a lot to talk about after you've seen it, not least of which is the quality of the performances, I would say. Amir Ebrahimi, she won Best Actress at Cannes, very sort of deserving winner of that accolade. And the guy who plays Saeed as well, Mehdi Badjistani, he's just very unnerving, a very sort of disturbing performance, very unsettling how sort of normal he is more than anything. Like, he's not sort of mustache twirly, like, he's just kind of a normal guy who does these awful things,
and it feels absolutely right in what he's doing. He literally doesn't think it's he's doing anything wrong. He's doing work. This is work that he should be doing.
Vocation for him. The conviction is that's up there with the most disturbing things about it. Like, there's just no question about what he's doing at this point. And you do get these really, you know, we've described the killings a little bit. Obviously, we don't want to, go into morbid details with them, but some of them are really quite protracted and extended and quite tense. You know, you see like Saeed and his victims in a room for 5 or 10 minutes before anything happens. Like, they're talking, there's a lot of build up to it at points, which, you know, as a piece of filmmaking, it's undoubtedly effective. It's just whether, you know, that's sort of how you want to spend your Saturday night watching something.
Yeah.
That's sort of chilling.
Yeah, it's not fun, any of it. Mm-hmm. None of it's fun.
Not remotely.
It does feel like a film that's important to see.
There is actually an Iranian version of this story as well, called The Spider Killer, which I haven't seen, but I can only imagine that it's a film with all the edges kind of taken off that this has, you know. And I think in some ways it is important for you to have some of the things that you have in this, you know, the just unvarnished killings, just how sort of nasty it gets. It really puts it right in your face. I think that is sort of important in some ways. So you can just see how disturbing and totally messed up this whole situation was on a societal level and, you know, on the obvious level. Whereas, you know, any other kind of version of this, would it have been as effective? Probably not. But then the other question is, do we really need to see this on screen in our so-called entertainment? Like, who knows? These are all things that you've got to kind of come to a conclusion about yourself, really, where you draw the line.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of that Aparna Sen film, The Rapist, that came out last year, in as much as it really asks us to look at our societies where women are being just disposable. And, you know, even in the UK, 2 women a week are killed. So it's not that it's like looking at something from a foreign field. We can look at these films and ask ourselves the same question. Why? Mm-hmm. Why does this happen? Why is it basically kind of accepted that this brutality against women is happening daily? And why are the men that perpetrate it very often unrepentant and feel that they're absolutely justified? So it feels like a really important film, like I said, and I liked it, but it's something I never want to watch again.
Yeah, I saw it at Cannes, and I sort of chose not to rewatch it for this podcast just because I didn't really want to put myself through it again, even though I absolutely respect the filmmaking.
Yeah. Okay, so Holy Spider is out in cinemas this Friday, and it will be on Mubi as well from the 10th of March, so you can watch it at home or on the big screen. Shall we move on then to our final film? It's this.
We just really want you to relax.
Relax in what way?
My beautiful girl.
Hey, baby. Is everything okay?
What's going on?
So I think I'm gonna have to leave early.
When did he become more important to you than us?
Alice, darling.
I lied to him. He has every right to be angry.
Lied about what?
About being here.
There's my girl.
So this is Alice, darling. Alice is played by Anna Kendrick. She's a young seemingly professional young woman having a wonderful life with a wonderful boyfriend, British boyfriend called Simon, who is an artist. They appear to have, on the surface, a lovely relationship, but she meets up with her friends and is nervy. As we watch her go for a week of sort of a girly week with her friends, this relationship becomes apparent that it's coercive, it's abusive, that Simon isn't the dreamy artist boyfriend that we might have thought. And what will she do about it? And what will her friends be able to do about it? Jordan, you didn't see this. Schedules did not allow you.
Sadly not.
But I did. And it's not a good week for women based on Holy Spider and Alice Darling.
Oh, no.
But again, this is an interesting film that is about the slipperiness of abusive relationships that are not physically abusive. The slipperiness of coercion that, you know, at one point Alice says, he doesn't hurt me, but he does, obviously, psychologically, emotionally. He belittles her. He requires perfection from her and puts her in a position that is just impossible to actually live under those sort of rules. They're rules, essentially, that he's making for her. And she pulls out her hair as a sort of stress mechanism that is absolutely horrible to watch. Great clumps of hair that she's flushing down the toilet as she just yanks it out of the back of her head. But the conversations that she has with her friends are really interesting because it's this very delicate push-pull of the friends are aware something's wrong. They don't quite know what. They don't want to be judgy with their friend about what this relationship's about. And she finds it very difficult to admit to them because there's so much shame involved as well. And that's what I think is really interesting about this film, the shame associated with this that women feel, and the fact that she feels she's failing her boyfriend, but she's also failing her friends. And over this week, it delicately comes out that she's not happy and that it's not right and what will happen. So it's about the power of female friendship and the power of a sort of sisterhood, if you will, to discuss those things, but also really interesting for anybody to watch to understand the weird nuance and the insidiousness of a coercive relationship. Yeah, there's no big slapping about or, you know, beating her up or taking away her money, but there is this insidious pressure, and that's, I think, really well done in this. And also, they all sing Lisa Loeb's "I Miss You" repeatedly. So I enjoyed that. That was a little light
touch. And speaking of light touches, it sounds like a really interesting role for Anna Kendrick to have taken on, of all people. Because
we think of her so chirpy, don't we?
Exactly. Yeah. I can't imagine her not sort of quipping throughout a film. I assume that isn't the case in this one.
Yeah. And I think they really play with that casting by making it about her, because that's what you expect, you know. And she loves to sing, but then when she sings this song, it's heartbreaking because she doesn't sing. She's sad, she's depressed, she's locked in this weird emotional prison. And it's a really interesting role to see her play, but also I like the fact that it does play with our expectations of the kind of roles that she usually takes. Wonmi Mosaku is one of her friends, and she's just delightful. I love this girl. I'd like to see her do more, but she is wonderful in this. And also, she taught me that there's a difference between an axe and a maul. Did you know that?
I had no idea. What is the difference?
Weight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, an axe is like a lighter weight thing, and a maul is one of those big, heavy, splitting rocks things. It's a maul, M-A-L-L. So I've learned something. Oh. I feel like at some point in my life, that might come up and save my life. Like, do you know the difference? Yes, I do. Thank you. So thanks to that. But yeah, no, it's a very small film, quiet film, but quite impactful. And, you know, trigger warning for anybody who might go and see it. It's probably distressing for anyone who's experienced this or is watching somebody go through this. But equally, it might be something that's a helpful film to help identify something, or, you know, somebody who feels that they can't tell their friends something that's happening in their life, maybe this might be a way to open that conversation. I don't know. But yeah, it feels like another film I don't want to watch again that I liked. That's the theme for this week. In fact, that's the theme for all of these. All three of these films I don't ever want to watch again.
Yeah, but
but they are very good. Yeah. Okay. Do you fancy it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I'll definitely be checking this out as my earliest opportunity. I'm primarily excited just to see Anna Kendrick do something a bit different, because I think she is a sort of very engaging, charismatic presence on screen, and it's sort of a shame that she's been stuck in that stuck on the more comedy side of things. Like, I think she probably has a bit more range than that.
Yeah. Okay, so that is Alice Darling, and that is in cinemas this Friday. So Jordan, you've only seen two films, but your film of the week?
Yeah. Oh, tough one. I really like them both. I'm going to go with Babylon, though. I'm going to rep Babylon because I know it wasn't your favourite and I really, really liked it.
Well, you'd be surprised. I would probably say it's my favourite of this week as well.
Oh, wow.
Purely.
I went for the wrong one.
Purely for that the first hour, which I have seen twice, because I saw the first hour as a sneak peek and then I saw the whole film. And that first hour still stood up as just virtuoso filmmaking. Absolutely incredible. So worth it for that.
After you watched the first hour, did you think this is going to be the greatest film of all time? Is that
yes? Yeah, I can remember saying to the studio, oh my god, if it maintains that, it's going to be my film of the year for next year. And then I saw the rest of it.
I still think the rest of it is pretty good for the most part.
Okay, right, so that's it for this week. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you're all set. But before we go, we do have a listener's question, which ties in very nicely to the whole Babylon of it. What is the best film about Hollywood?
It's a tough one. I'm going to go with Mulholland Drive, though. David Lynch's surrealist, nightmarish masterpiece. About a young actress played by Naomi Watts looking to make a big break in the City of Angels. And, you know, and because it's Lynch, there's very little of the glamour. This is all the dark underbelly that we're dealing with here. People popping out from behind bins and literally scaring people to death, that kind of stuff. You know, but what it does so beautifully in Hollywood movie terms is it gets into the headspace of someone who is sort of chewed up and spat out by that system, which on a purely numbers basis just has to be the experience that most people in Hollywood go through. Like, most people don't get to see the Babylon side of things. Just generally, I think the film is a masterpiece, but as a film about Hollywood, it's also really, really great.
Yep. Excellent. Yep. I would have to say Singing in the Rain is, you know, we mentioned it earlier, still an absolute classic. Corker. But my more modern version about Hollywood that I still think is great and still stands up and still shows the machinations, the stupidity, the dream factory-ness of it is The Player, and the meetings that people have, you know, the pitches that go on, like Richard E. Grant's character pitching his movie, which is just absolute rubbish. And that's the one that gets made with Julia Roberts and Bruce Willis. I love it. And the whole idea of the studio backlot and people driving around on golf carts, it's totally like that. I was on a backlot last week. Every time I walk onto a backlot of a studio and people are driving around on golf carts, I think of The Player and think it's ridiculous. It's really like this. So, that would be my choice. But there's plenty more to choose from, obviously. There are so many films about,
Hollywood loves making movies about itself. It really does, doesn't it?
Navel gazing. Of course it does. Okay, so on that note, I think we should probably say goodbye. Do you want to do it in the, I don't know, we should do it in the style of a Hollywood star?
Goodbye.
Oh, it's been wonderful having you here. Goodbye.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you. Would it be a sin if I can't